Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast for Thursday, the 20th of February. I'm Jane Hill. Just how serious is the rift between the US and Ukraine, with Donald Trump's national security adviser calling President Zelensky's recent remarks unacceptable and a news conference cancelled at the last minute? We speak to a Ukrainian pollster about the impact the war of words is having inside the country. As the bodies of four hostages are returned to Israel from Gaza, we hear from a woman waiting for a family friend to be released by Hamas this weekend. And what's the future for the iconic British creation 007? As creative control of James Bond films is to pass from the legendary Broccoli family to Amazon MGM, I've been getting reaction from the director of two Bond movies. You're listening to The World Tonight with Jane Hill. Just how serious, then, is the rift between the US administration and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky? Today in Kyiv, as we've heard, the US Special Envoy for Ukraine and Russia, Keith Kellogg, was due to hold a news conference with the Ukrainian leader, but it was abruptly cancelled, we're told, by the Americans. Since then, there have been reports from the Reuters news agency that the US has declined to co-sponsor a draft UN resolution marking 3 years since Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that backs the country's territorial integrity and again demands Russia withdraw its troops. And in a separate G7 statement, sources have tonight told the Financial Times that Washington is objecting to calling Russia the aggressor. Speaking at the White House today, the US National Security Advisor Mike Waltz was clear that President Trump was personally affronted by some of the remarks coming from Volodymyr Zelensky this week.
There has been ongoing fighting on both sides. It is World War I style trench warfare. His frustration with President Zelensky is that you've heard is multifold. One, there needs to be a deep appreciation for what the American people, what the American taxpayer, what President Trump did in his first term, and what we've done since. So some of the rhetoric coming out of Kyiv, frankly, and insults to President Trump were unacceptable.
He also laid the blame on the Ukrainian government for not engaging in Donald Trump's discussions with Russia.
President Trump is obviously very frustrated right now with President Zelensky. The fact that that he hasn't come to the table, that he hasn't been willing to take this opportunity that we have offered. I think he eventually will get to that point, and I hope so very quickly.
Well, let's talk more about all of that with our North America correspondent, Nomia Iqbal. Nomia, evening. I mean, from where we sit, it seems that the Trump administration is developing a real antipathy towards Ukraine's leadership, perhaps even towards the whole Ukrainian cause. Is that the sense where you are?
Well, I think there's definitely a great deal of impatience. Look, Donald Trump wants to get a deal done. He promised on the campaign trail that he'd end the war on day one of his presidency. He clearly hasn't done that. I also think there's a sense of annoyance by the Trump administration that President Zelensky is not playing ball. He's challenging Donald Trump, saying he's been taken in by Russian disinformation after falsely saying Ukraine started the war. And it was interesting, that clip you played by Mike Waltz, he was also asked directly a question about, well, who did start the war in Ukraine? He dodged that question. And he also dodged the question about whether President Trump sees the Russian president as a dictator, because Donald Trump has had a lot of things to say about President Zelensky, but not about Mr. Putin. But that's always the way with Donald Trump's staff. They never actually want to criticize him. In terms of the cause, I think Trump has always been clear that Ukraine's support wasn't guaranteed. It's a position that is popular with his supporters, even those that don't support him. But I just think we won't know for sure what he feels until it comes to giving aid. At the moment, military assistance is still being provided to Ukraine by the US. And if it is cut off, well, there are many Republicans, actually, who are pro-Ukraine and have already called Mr. Trump out over his comments.
Okay. What about those reports tonight as well that the administration is withholding support for some of those diplomatic statements condemning Russia's invasion? What more are you hearing about that?
Well, it's interesting because since the war, the US has always referred to Russia as an aggressor, certainly under President Biden's administration. And there is a UN resolution that's coming due to mark the 3 years since the invasion, which the US is co-sponsoring. But as you mentioned there, there are reports that the US is saying, well, we're not going to do that unless the language is changed. Worth remembering, it's not legally binding the resolution, but they do carry political weight and reflect global sentiment on the war. Now, we haven't it hasn't been confirmed for sure if this is true, but if indeed it is true, I think the Trump administration's insistence on softening the language is not surprising. It again reflects this huge shift in U.S. policy. But if you look at the recent statements that came out of the U.S. Department of State, they use similar wording. There was a readout from the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, his meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Saudi Arabia, and that twice mentioned the conflict in Ukraine. They didn't use the term aggressor. So we'll have to see when that UN resolution does come out. But we understand that they're still working on the phrasing of it.
All right. Nomia, thank you. Nomia Iqbal there in Washington. Well, we've talked this week about the condemnation which came from many European leaders when President Trump described President Zelensky as a dictator. Tonight, Elon Musk echoed that sort of language. He claimed that Volodymyr Zelensky is despised by the people of Ukraine. So what impact is this war of words having inside the country? Is it undermining Ukrainian people's confidence in President Zelensky? I've been talking to Anton Grushetsky. He's a pollster and executive director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology. And I asked him firstly how President Zelensky had been polling.
He still has a widespread support in the Ukrainian society. He is still perceived as a legitimate head of the state. And actually, it also shows that for the majority of Ukrainians, they don't demand any elections right now.
Was his polling ever as low as 4%, as the US president has said?
Never. Before the full-scale invasion, 35% of Ukrainians trusted him, so he had much lower trust level than it was when he was elected as a president. But then it surged to 90% after the full-scale invasion, then it decreased to 52% in December. But actually, since the full-scale invasion, the lowest level was like 50-52%.
And would people that you talk to ever describe him as a dictator?
Almost never. Surely we have like 10 to 20% who do not like our president for certain reasons, and they could also like explain why. And perhaps, I think like 10 to 15% could say he's like a dictator, not a very good guy, but it's a minority. For the absolute majority, he's a legitimate head of the state. Even those who doesn't trust him, who criticize him, still says like, we don't need elections right now. He's legitimate. Actually, like, so we'll need to wait until war ends and only then conduct elections.
And so how much do you know at this stage about the impact of President Trump's attacks on him? To what extent is that having an impact at all?
It has impact right now. We cannot say how long-term impact it would be, because it would depend on how much time Trump and his administration will dedicate to attacks on our president. But right now, like, more and more people are saying, like, we trust Zelensky, he's still legitimate, and actually people are very disappointed. And actually the question not even about trust level to Zelensky, but all the statements said by Trump. First of all, that he said that Ukraine to be blamed for the war. And people are like very furious because of this, because people in Ukraine clearly know that the only Russia to be blamed for the war. And actually, when people heard all these statements, like President Zelensky is a bad guy, a dictator, Ukraine to be blamed for the war, and all other not very correct statements, people say, then we should support our president.
Oh, so actually it's benefiting him in a strange way.
Yes, in a strange way, because people say like it's our president, it's only our right to criticize him and like to say when we should have elections. So if we don't like him right now, we have very good record in our history of protesting and saying like you should like step up as a president. Right now we are not protesting because we know that for this moment priority number one is to strengthen our defense forces and to like stimulate our defense activities again in this war.
Are there political opponents of Volodymyr Zelensky who have responded to some of what President Trump has been saying?
Actually, lots of them also criticized President Zelensky, like for not like appropriate communication with the Trump administration, etc. But mostly they agree that they're against elections right now. For example, the leader of the opposition, one of the biggest opposition parties, Petro Poroshenko, our former president, he states clearly we don't need elections right now. All other oppositional parties and leaders mainly say also that we don't need elections right now. Yes, there are some things why we should criticize Zelensky, but we cannot say that he's illegitimate head of the state. It's like pro-Russian narrative. It's like a tactic used by Russia to ruin our unity and to destabilize society. And firstly, we need to achieve success in the front line. Then we'll discuss elections.
Anton Grzechowski there, executive director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology. Now, let me just point you to something a little different coming up later in the programme.
Did I get your tail back on properly, Eeyore?
No matter. Most likely lose it again anyway.
Is the donkey unfairly maligned in popular culture? As a new university film course examines portrayals of the animal, I've been speaking to a donkey expert and enthusiast. That's coming up a little later in the programme. But before that, we return our attentions to the Middle East because Israel says it will step up its offensive in the West Bank after explosions on three empty buses in the city of Bat Yam, south of Tel Aviv. Two devices found on other buses were defused. There have been no reports of casualties. It comes on the day that the bodies of four hostages who were taken into Gaza alive during the October the 7th attacks were returned in coffins. Israel's President Isaac Herzog said the hearts of an entire nation lie in tatters. Hamas says the bodies are those of Shiri Bibas and her two infant sons. So far, Israel has confirmed only the identity of the fourth person, Oded Lifshitz. He was 84 and a veteran peace activist. Footage of Shiri Bibas, you probably remember, clutching her children as they were being kidnapped, captured the horror of that October attack. Hamas claimed in late 2023 that the family had been killed in an Israeli airstrike without providing any evidence, and the Israeli government has never confirmed that claim. Well, more hostages who are alive are due to be released this Saturday. One of them is Omer Venkert, and I've been speaking to Mia Stone, a British Jewish woman and a family friend of Omer's. And I began by asking her what her emotions were today.
Honestly, since October 7th, 2023, and I'm sure you've heard this a lot, it's just been a roller coaster of emotions. You remain happy when you hear news and you see the videos of the hostages coming back with their families, and then you're again hit by tragic news. I feel like you can never really be completely happy because you always have to prepare for the worst may happen, or there are constant changes. So Omer, his uncle, is best friends with my dad, and they grew up together in Petah Tikva in Israel. And I never met him, but I feel like, just like with the rest of the British Jewish community, we feel like we really know these hostages. We really know and feel the pain from their families. And I've been campaigning, I guess, as well as for the Bibas family, which I'm devastated to hear about today. Some of us were hopeful, some of us were expecting the worst as a coping mechanism. And also Oded Lifshitz, who I know campaigned strongly and worked closely with helping Palestinians as well. And just the fact that he's been confirmed dead today is just awful and devastating too.
Yes, and people all over the world have been watching those images and the staging almost that Hamas put those four coffins on. What on earth went through your mind when you saw that?
I don't think it's out of character. I would describe it like a Black Mirror episode that I think we're living in. Before the releases were happening and Hamas are posting constantly on their Twitter with background music and effects and videos and making the hostages say what they want to say, I remember watching one video, which I know had Noah in and two other hostages, and it was kind of like a video of who will be alive tomorrow, who will be dead. And it's like a sick, twisted game show. So when you asked me how I felt today, I wasn't surprised. You're just horrified. There's nothing really that they could do that would shock me. in the way in which it was done as well. Just so insensitive. And my heart goes out to the Bibas family and to Yarden, who's come back to an empty home.
And you yourself have been campaigning for the release of all hostages since the October the 7th attacks. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and the impact that has had on you?
Yeah, so I was in Israel for a month when the war started, and I came back to London, and putting up posters was something small we felt we could do to show, you know, the British public who the hostages were, because I feel that the Israeli hostages have been completely dehumanized. And when I was putting up posters around London, one man on the street kind of turned to me and just said, "What about the Palestinians?" And I think it's important to have healthy conversations or stray from your bubble and try to facilitate conversations with people that may have grown up from a different background or area to you, or may see a different side of the media to you. So I turned and said, "Do you know anybody in Gaza who's affected? Do you have a poster? Do you want to put your poster next to mine?" And I just remember he pulled the poster of Kafir, the 6-month baby that was kidnapped from his home, and ripped it in front of me and just spat nearby where I was standing. And that was me trying to just facilitate an open conversation and try to do what I can from this side to spread awareness and hear other people's opinions, because this war is very complicated, and that's kind of the treatment I got back from it.
Your point was that you were trying to say to him, "I understand that there are people suffering in Gaza too."
Yeah, even though the conflict is complicated, we should have real moral clarity that suffering on all fronts are bad. I hear all the time that people talk about this war as if it's some sort of football match, and they say, "Are you Israel or Palestine?" And you have to choose and back one team over the other. And people forget that there are people behind it, and it's not just a popular trend.
Mia Stone there, reflecting on this weekend as she waits for a family friend to be released by Hamas. A reminder of the main headlines so far tonight on The World Tonight. President Trump's national security adviser has urged Kyiv to rein in its criticism of the US, saying it should instead negotiate over Ukrainian rare earth minerals. Spain's former football chief, Luis Rubiales, has been found guilty of sexually assaulting a player by kissing her without consent after their World Cup win in 2023. And here, a coroner has ruled that failures by the army in dealing with sexual harassment were partly to blame for the death of a 19-year-old soldier who took her own life. Now, we turn to someone who really needs little introduction.
I admire your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
My name is Bond. James Bond.
Bond. James Bond.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Yes, we heard there the six actors who've played Ian Fleming's MI6 agent on the big screen. Can you name them all? It's like a pub quiz, isn't it? Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton, Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig there. But it is more than 3 years since the last film, No Time to Die, and there have been inevitable questions about the future of the franchise. Well, today, big news for Bond fans. The Broccoli family, who've been at the production helm from the beginning, will no longer have creative control. The films are to be produced by Amazon MGM Studios, which was formed 3 years ago. So what could this mean for this great British creation? I've been speaking to Campbell, Martin Campbell. He's the director of two Bond films, GoldenEye and Casino Royale, and he worked with those producers, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, and he told me what that was like.
Well, they were simply the best. I mean, they controlled all of the Bond film. I mean, Barbara's father, of course, Cuppy Broccoli, was one of the original producers. And I think GoldenEye was actually the first film that they produced together. As producers, they were absolutely terrific. I mean, they give you a very free hand in directing. Obviously, they're involved in the script writing, as I was and as the other directors were. In other words, they let you make the film you want to make.
And now then, creative control will go to Amazon MGM Studios. I mean, of course, what we wait to find out, I suppose, is exactly what creative control means.
Yeah, exactly. Well, all I'd heard of was, of course, there was this conflict that I think Barbara quite rightly wanted to keep the status quo. Bond is always an event movie, basically, and it deserves the big screen. That's something I think that's where, from her side anyway, the argument was. I assume Amazon probably wants spin-offs, and obviously they'll exploit the library. Perhaps they'll want some spin-off characters from Bond as well. I don't know.
Would you welcome that if that turned out to be the case?
Not for me, no. I much prefer it as it was. I much prefer that they were one-off movies, and I would just keep the status quo if it were me, I have to say.
But I know you were a Bond fan from a very, very young age, so why would you not want spin-offs? Would that dilute things for you? What would your concern be?
Well, my concern would be that so often with these spin-offs, they don't work, if you see what I mean. They simply don't work. And I mean, I can only take the MCU situation where a lot of these spin-offs don't work, right? But, you know, Bond, for me, there's something about his character, just keeping him as Bond rather than, you know, ending up with, there are obviously several villains, for example, in Bond films that presumably you could have a spin-off with. There's M, there's, you know, you name it. But for me, I'm kind of old-fashioned. I just want those great Bond films, right, that I've seen since 1962. I want them to keep doing what they've been doing.
Yes. Is it, dare I suggest, it's generational? People perhaps of our sort of generations want things to stay the same, but actually a new, younger audience, people in their teens and 20s and 30s, they've grown up with streaming and they want something different.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, they want something different. But Bond, in a way, has always been about quality. They spend the money. I know on Casino and Goldeneye, you know, we had the budget to make those movies. And there's a certain kind of quality and panache that Bond has that very few other movies have. And, you know, Bond as a character is a one-off. Right.
I mean, I can't let you go without asking you who you might have in mind to replace Daniel Craig. I mean, is it time for a female Bond, for example?
No, I don't agree with a female Bond. I don't agree with it. You know, I'd stick with Ian Fleming. And who would play the part, God knows. I don't know enough at the moment because I've been out of England for a long time. I have no idea who whoever it is should be British, no question about it. I mean, Pierce is Irish, but nevertheless, it is great. I let him off because of that. But he certainly should be British.
Martin Campbell there, the director of two Bond films. If you're in a position to save any money at all during this cost of living crisis, there's a good chance you're putting it into a cash ISA. Millions of people in the UK have one, the attraction being they are tax-free. Adults can save up to £20,000 a year without paying tax on the interest. But it's been reported that there are discussions in government about reducing that amount. Some suggestions, perhaps the maximum could be reduced to just £4,000 a year. So what could that mean for consumers? Let's ask Sarah Pennells. She's a consumer finance specialist at the pensions and investment firm Royal London. Sarah, good evening to you. I mean, they're very popular product, aren't they? So what could this mean?
You're right, they are popular. About 22 million adults have one at the moment. I think it's just worth having a bit of a history lesson because ISAs have been around for over 25 years. And as you said, people can now put £20,000 any tax year, either into a cash ISA or stocks and shares. But when they were introduced, it was very different. So the amount you could save was less, not surprisingly, but you could only save up to half that amount in cash. So it's only in the last 10 years that you could put the whole ISA allowance into cash. So if this is something, and it's a big if, that the government is thinking about, in some ways, it would bring the ISA regime into full circle. But that's not to say there aren't pros and cons if that's an approach the government decides to take.
Ah, interesting. So it's sort of a bit of history. We talked about millions of people having an account. That doesn't mean they've all got the maximum 20,000, does it? So what are the sort of average figures, therefore?
It's really interesting because there's quite a lot of focus on the amount that you can put in, the maximum amount. But again, if you unpick it and look at what people pay in, the average amount people put in any one tax year is about £1,200. I mean, that's a fraction of the £20,000 allowance. And that figure is fairly constant, ups and downs, and people tend to put more money in stocks and shares, ISA, than cash. But even so, most people are nowhere near the allowance limit. So if the government was to change the cash ISA limit, many people wouldn't be affected. But I think whenever the government makes a change to a financial product, particularly the tax treatment, people who aren't affected get very worried and sometimes make short-term decisions that can affect their longer-term finances.
Yes, that's interesting. Should people be worried? How quickly, for example, could anything like this come into effect?
Well, I think, what would probably be unlikely is that the government would make the changes retrospective. So if you've got money in cash ISAs already, if it was going to make this change, it would be saying, actually, from now on, you can only put a more limited amount in cash savings. I mean, I think just to take a bit of a step back, I mean, it is a good thing that people have cash savings. So we've been doing research into the cost of living since 2022, and there's actually quite a chunk of people, about one in five, who say they couldn't cope with an emergency bill of more than £250. Now, that's not great for them. That's a very precarious position to be. It's also not great for society as a whole if people are taking on debt, for example, to pay those emergency bills. But, you know, there's £300 billion in cash ISAs. There's a lot of money sloshing around. Some of that will be for emergency cash, but quite a lot of it is probably been money people have put in there year after year when actually, if you look at the figures over the longer term, although obviously stocks and shares comes with risk, you could do better if you invest.
Sarah Pennells from Royal London, good to have your expertise. Thanks very much. It is more than 2.5 months since South Korea's president provoked a constitutional crisis in his country by declaring martial law. He justified his power grab by claiming that pro-North Korea communist forces had infiltrated the parliament and were trying to overthrow the country. He didn't provide any evidence, but 2 months on from the failed coup, his supporters have been whipped into an anti-communist frenzy. And as conspiracy theories take hold, support for the impeached and imprisoned president appears to be growing. Thousands of people are taking to the streets every week to demand his release as the country's political crisis deepens. Our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie, has been following the protests.
I'm near South Korea's constitutional court, where at the moment the impeached and imprisoned president is testifying, and his supporters have rallied outside. They want him released, they want him returned to office, and they are shouting some pretty extreme things. They're saying that the left-leaning opposition party are communists and that the leader of the opposition should be executed. Why are you here today?
This moment is the conflict between the people who pursue communists and the people who pursue democracy.
When the president here declared martial law, he justified this extreme move by claiming that the parliament had been infiltrated by people who were pro-North Korea, pro-communist. Now, he didn't provide any evidence, but since then, these ideas have really taken hold.
My name is Jungmin, and I'm 22 years old.
Why are you worried about North Korea?
If the next president would be the leader of Democratic Party, what he's talking about is to become one with Kim Jong-un.
There's no denying these threats used to be very real. I've climbed to the top of one of my favourite mountains in Seoul. There's a tree here which is covered in bullet marks. These are from a battle here in 1968 when a group of North Korean commandos crawled across the border and tried to assassinate the president. During this time, spies would regularly try to infiltrate the government. And it was common for South Korea's military dictators to accuse their political opponents of conspiring with Pyongyang. Experts say Mr. Yoon has exploited these historic fears.
Before Yoon Suk-yeol, we did have extreme groups saying extreme things.
Sang-shin Lee is a polling expert for the Korea Institute for National Unification.
But they were isolated. But now Yoon Suk-yeol gave those extreme words presidential authority. When he says that the left-wing liberal political parties are North Korea sympathizers, people believe that.
It's a Saturday afternoon, and the main road through the center of Seoul has been closed off to traffic because thousands of people have come out to support Mr. Yoon. They're waving Korean flags, holding placards. There are speakers up on a stage. These aren't just Mr. Yoon's core supporters, older, ultra-conservatives. There are young people here today. There are people who, before this martial law crisis, didn't even support the president.
Like most young people, I thought, how can martial law be declared in the 21st century? I was very critical. But after researching it on YouTube, I realized I was wrong. It was unavoidable. If I had been in the president's position, I'd have done it too.
Something people keep telling me is that they don't trust mainstream media. Even the conservative press here has been very critical of Mr. Yoon. And so these people have turned to YouTube, where there are these very popular right-wing channels that are amplifying these sort of messages. One idea the president has dangled that has really taken hold is that China interfered in South Korea's election last year and rigged the result. I noticed that you're holding a sign which says CCP out, so Chinese Communist Party out. Why is that?
지금 모든 우리나라 정세가
I believe China is interfering in all our political affairs. It is pulling the strings behind the scenes. I didn't fully understand the extent of it until recently.
The protest turned violent last month when a group of young men smashed up a courthouse looking to take revenge against a judge who'd helped detain the president. These were shocking scenes for a country which prides itself on its tradition of peaceful protest. Kim Jong-sik, a young Conservative Party supporter, was there.
I heard people saying, now our country is in the hands of China and South Korea will become like Hong Kong. Not a single politician has been critical of China, but President Yoon was brave enough to speak out.
These views could create problems for the country's opposition Democratic Party. I've come to the parliament to meet one of their most seasoned politicians.
I am Wee Song Lak. I'm a lawmaker from the Democratic Party.
What do you say to these claims that it is the Democratic Party that is secretly colluding with North Korea, secretly colluding with China?
They are simply not true, cooked up concept to demonize the opposition and to justify martial law. Probably these ideas may spread a little bit further. Majority of people understand what's going on, and majority of people are yearning for the return to normalcy.
The court is expected to rule in the next month on whether to bar Mr. Yoon from office. Then there would be elections, and South Korea will have the chance to move on. But just like the bullet holes on this mountain, people's memories and fears of the past will always be here. Politicians now are going to have to work really hard to put this country back together.
Jean McKenzie there in South Korea. Now, we did promise something a little different. A new film studies module at Exeter University is aiming to rehabilitate the reputation of the donkey. Called Beasts Unburdened, the course explores how the portrayal of donkeys has affected public attitudes towards them, because they're so often suggested to be stubborn, gloomy and not very intelligent. Dr. Faith Burden is the Deputy Chief Executive of the Donkey Sanctuary in Sidmouth in Devon, which some of the film students have been visiting. How does she feel donkeys are portrayed in popular culture?
Over now to Ascot in Berkshire, where Mrs. Peter Cadbury and daughter Felicity have discussed a way to take some of the donkey work out of shopping. They take a real donkey along to do the work. Actually, Bambi, their one-year-old pet donkey...
They're often portrayed incorrectly, so they're often seen as either stubborn or slightly melancholic or often a character that's there to be laughed at.
Now, this is the carrot race. You don't ride your donkey, you bribe him if you can.
The donkeys that we see in popular culture, whether it's film or storybooks that we often read as children, often really characterise donkeys as something that they're not in our experience.
Did I get your tail back on properly, Eeyore?
No matter. Most likely lose it again anyway.
So they're not stubborn at all, is that just wrong?
What we misconceive as being stubborn is the donkey taking a moment to weigh up its options. So often a donkey will stop and consider what the best option is. We often compare them to the cousin, the horse. Now, a horse is often very quick to run away. A donkey will not be rushed, and actually I think they have wonderful common sense.
Eeyore, what has happened to your tail?
What has happened to it?
Well, it isn't there.
That accounts for a good deal. That explains everything. No wonder.
So I'm getting a picture here of an animal that takes its time. It'll weigh up and then it will reach a conclusion and then go for that course of action.
That's right. We often call it donkey time. So they need the time to make the right decision. And when they've made it, normally it's absolutely the safest option for them. So that's why they were often used in wartime to carry either injured soldiers or perhaps to carry the most valuable cargo for an army.
And people hearing about this today might be surprised to learn that there's enough in this field that you work in to turn into a film course.
It's giving the students the opportunity to understand the importance of accurate portrayal of animal species. So they start the course by looking at a number of different films involving donkeys. So obviously we have the classics like Donkey and Shrek.
I live alone, my swamp, me, nobody else, understand? Nobody! Especially useless, pathetic, annoying, talking donkeys!
There's also Eeyore from the Winnie the Pooh books, but some more recent films, such as The Banshees of Inisherin and Io, both of which were nominated for Oscars in 2023. That was a nice lead-in to the students actually coming to meet some of our real-life donkeys.
It's so interesting that you mentioned The Banshees of Inisherin, because that was one of my favourite films of that year. Mm-hmm. And for people who haven't seen it, there's really quite a lovely relationship between one of the key characters, the Colin Farrell character, and his donkey.
Him and his little donkey.
What about me, little donkey?
Absolutely. So she's his unspeaking, loyal companion, isn't she? And it really beautifully depicts that relationship between people and donkeys. And of course, it's a relationship that's special still all around the world, where donkeys are working animals, supporting people's livelihoods.
Dr. Faith Burden there from the Donkey Sanctuary in Sidmouth in Devon. I love that phrase. Donkey time. Might make use of that. And that is The World Tonight for this evening. From me, Jane Hill, and the whole team, we wish you a very good night.